I should probably introduce myself. My name is Bernice Ting. I'm the coordinator of this symposium. Our next guest speaker joined the cooking lab as the head chef and co-author of 6 beautiful volumes of modernist cuisine in 2007. Currently, he directs the research and development of recipes and culinary techniques with a team of 4 other full-time chefs. He has led this team to events in Seattle and abroad, serving food of modernist cuisine to influential culinary thinkers, chefs, students, and journalists. He graduated with highest honors from the Ice Culinary School in New York City and became head chef at Jack's Luxury Oyster Bar at the age of 22. Later, he worked with Heston Blumenthal in the development of kitchen at the Fat Duck. Our speaker is also an active volunteer with the Hunger Intervention Program's Community Kitchen, the Gossett Place Youth Center, and the Quick Help for Meals at the University of Southern California. Named by Forbes as one of the top 30 under 30 in the food and wine industry, it is my great pleasure to welcome to the stage Mr. Maxime Billet.
Thank you for having me. Let's see. So, there you are. How's everyone doing? So let's see if we can get our presentation going. All right. So we're right at the beginning. So how many of you are familiar with modernist cuisine? Please raise your hand. All right, this is good. So I get to explain to you a little bit about the context of our project. Now, it was a very visual project, and it was a very sort of wide-ranging project. So I have a nice, beautiful photo of a borage blossom that I love. I have it on my wall at home. But this is our book. This is a book that was, when I came onto the project, was only designed to be a very small volume on sous vide cooking. And after 4 years working with Nathan, Nathan Myhrvold was the founder of this project and the leader of this movement that I feel we really empowered. It went from being 200 pages to 5,000, and we've created this encyclopedia that covers all of cooking, the history, the science, all of the techniques, bridging from tradition to high modernism, and incorporating things that are very approachable and very novel. And I'm very excited to be able to share with you today that full spectrum. So I'm going to go pretty quickly through all the possibilities. Again, this project was very visual, so a lot of the photography was intended to be very constructive in demonstrating the scientific, chemical, physical aspects of every process, whether it was steaming or sous vide cooking, or using a centrifuge, and I think there's a lot there to be shared between all of you science, the culinary science students, but also any curious home cooks that are around. It was a very wide spectrum. So, having said that, let's begin. So, one of the big and relating to Hervétis' talk and all praise to him, he's been one of the great masters of sharing how science and food can be, and cooking really, are bound to each other. But there's a bridge there that must be recognized. We worked very hard to demonstrate how those boundaries, that this projection in our minds, has to be eliminated in order for food to progress. And so we had access to a lot of high-speed videos. We were rupturing a balloon at high speed. And then the cutaway. The cutaway is something that was very iconic of our process. And it's something that really is iconic of, again, our study of food, looking inside. we had access to a machine shop, which I'll show you in a second. And bridging the idea of tradition, innovation, modernism, modernist cuisine, molecular cuisine, as Avedis coins it, was a huge part of us wanting to study and explain what was so fascinating about traditional cooking first. That bridge was the most important to begin with. So steaming is actually slower than boiling because of the steam that accumulates on the outside of the food. This is a cutaway of stir-frying, of boiling, of a traditional pot roast, canning, you know, and literally in the book, we annotate all of this and say, you know, how is temperature affecting the food? What are the physics? What is the chemistry occurring within this? So that you, when you are applying these techniques at home, any home cook, any context, you have the information necessary to empower yourself to refine it, to make it better, to make it your own. Then you go into slightly more modernist applications. So the siphon, as again Alvade talks about, the siphon is a wonderful thing. Right now we're creating a foam, and the cutaway is kind of dramatic. You get to see why, how the nitrous oxide actually aerates as it's going through the siphon nozzle. And the siphon is actually a much more flexible piece of equipment. It's a pressure chamber. You can infuse, you can marinate, you can create all sorts of different textures. So it's again a fascinating piece of equipment. This is our morgue of cutaways. We pretty much cut away everything we could, and for the reason of education. Education was the heart of our project. We wanted to show how things worked, why they worked. And so we had access to things like water jets. We have a workshop that I'll show a photo of later. This water jet actually cuts everything in half with pressure, the pressure of water, and an abrasive, so sand. And you can cut, we've cut giant ovens and deep fryers in half just to show what happens. So here's a good photo, I guess a good video describing this process. And this is a different machine. This is the wire EDM. This pot that was used for that braised pork, the pork cutaway, is being cut by a water EDM machine. So electricity has cut through this metal. So as chefs, we have access to a shop where we can explore all these boundaries that you know didn't exist before. Pad Thai. I don't know how many of you love Pad Thai. I love a good Pad Thai. Often it's misrepresented or not properly done, but we wanted to show how the extreme heat from a wok made the Pad Thai what it should be. And I suffered a lot for it. So a lot of these photos were composites. We had to Photoshop a lot of these images together. And I remember this was like 3 weeks into my job. Almost I was an intern at that point. I had oil burns all over my arms just from tossing the hot oil towards my face. But it was worth it because I went to university for art and anything for art's sake. So having said that, having introduced sort of the principle of how we approach food, what the principle of our philosophy was about educating, people ask, what is modernist cuisine? What's its purpose? How is it different from traditional cooking? And I think it's a great segue from what Alvé was talking about again, is, you know, what's the future of cooking? And the future of cooking is, it's a very tricky question. It's one that's very personal, and the only binding factor for all of it is this very simple combination of words. It has to be delicious. It's the experience of food that makes it important. So whether it's, you know, out there, whether it's Willy Wonka floating balloons of bubblegum, or if it's a beautiful roast chicken, it still has to be delicious. It can't just be a cerebral experience. And we took that very seriously when we explored the book. And we also took that very seriously when we explored what was happening in the world. The nature of ingredients, you know, the dilution of the quality of ingredients is a big issue today. And we feel very responsible to communicate how important it is to use good ingredients. So we have, you know, it's very visual the way we do this, and I think it's a very rich communicative way to do that. Beautiful blueberries, cutaways of root vegetables in winter, perfectly cooked and glazed spring vegetables, a côte de bœuf. Who doesn't love a côte de bœuf where the outside is beautifully charred and the inside is perfectly medium rare? And then fine dining, short ribs that have been cooked for 72 hours at 60 Celsius, where you can see they're still pink, but you can cut them with a fork, and it's just a delicious experience. But it's again a part of process. It seems like it's fine dining, but it's also very approachable. So this is probably my favorite thing to talk about, and I know again I'm going to have to rush through a lot of these things because of the time, but it connects to what all of you are doing here, or the students that are here, and what the programs that are being developed here are, is this idea of interdisciplinary work. And so you think chef, scientist, physicist, chemist, there's a lot of isolation and specialization. And that makes a lot of sense. You know, there's so much knowledge out there that you have to focus on what you're learning and refine that process, that capacity, that realm of information as much as you can for yourself, for your future, for your career. What I think is so important and what I think is lacking is the dialogue between these various professions, these various specialties. And we had a great conversation earlier with all of the panel speakers and the great doctors and food scientists at the lunch we had earlier about how really that was the issue, and maybe bureaucracy is part of it, maybe resistance from the crowd is part of it. There are many reasons why it's not happening as quickly as it should. But there's no reason that there shouldn't be more dialogue between chefs, cooks, home cooks, scientists on various degrees, and everything in between, because we have so much to give each other. So this is my home. I live in a lab, and I call this a lab. It's really an experimental kitchen. We do not serve anyone. Our single purpose is to explore what food can become from a chef's point of view for the purpose of making delicious food. We do have an intention. So maybe, in a sense, our scientific process is not pure because we do have an end goal in mind, which is the pleasure and sustenance and overall joy that food can create through the experimentation that we go through. But if you can see, we have some very classic tools. We have a microwave, we have a stovetop, but we also have a high-speed centrifuge, a rotovap, some rotostator homogenizers, a freeze dryer, a spray dryer. And all of these things can contribute to making amazing food. But you have to have the right intention and the right amount of time and resource to develop that connection. And we were very lucky to have Nathan Mervold, our founder, give us that freedom and that resource to create. So this is our workshop where all of these sort of cutaways, and also basically these guys, these engineers, can create a car in a day. So if I need a pastry mold to create some wacky design for a laser cut omelet, they'll make it for us. And so we're very, very lucky to have this. This is Ted, one of the amazing engineers, and all these guys allow us to really create anything that we can imagine. Our imagination, our creative process can become that much richer by having access to engineers. And then we went into microbiology, so we had access to physicists, chemists, food safety, obviously, nutrition. nutritionists. We had access to all of these, like, the highest minds within each of these fields. So again, bringing and bridging all of these professions and professionals at the top of their science and knowledgeable level together. The science of water, the physics of heat, and a fried egg. A fried egg is, you know, a very physical, chemical process where, you know, how hot your frying pan is will determine the texture. How long you leave it in there, how moist it is, will determine its final, your final experience of it. And so you think about this basic chef who knows nothing, or this basic cook, fry cook on in a diner making a fried egg. Well, there was so much physics and chemistry involved, and we want to enlighten them and empower all of these people who are responsible for feeding us to have this information. This is a little bit of a little insight, layers of perception. So our book, again, as I'm sharing this with you, and our process was to be very visual. And so going very quickly through this, this is the chef's perspective. I had a chef spend 48 hours peeling every last little piece of shell from this lobster to show the structure of the muscle and also make a beautiful photo. But there's never been a peeled lobster in this way shown before. And we wanted to highlight how a lobster works, all of its muscle structure. Then we had a photographer take this amazing candled photo using lighting and looking at the structure of, this is onion paper. This is just the outside of an onion. And you can see all of the fiber, all of the membranes, and you know, it's almost a piece of art. I want this on my wall. But at the same time, it's fascinating how this works. What do you guys think this is? Sorry?
Starch granules.
Well, you should have been excluded from the question, because it's not fair. You know too much. Yes. So surprise ruins. These are potato starch granules. They've been colored, and now we've had a scientist look at them through a microscope. And again, so we're looking at food closer and closer, and exploration from a chef's point of view is fascinating, because then we were able to do so many things with potato starch that I wish I could feed you all a tasting menu of potato starch in informed variations. Unfortunately, that won't happen today, but come to Seattle and maybe we'll figure it out. Flavor. Flavor is everything. Flavor, again, I'll be talking about the importance of the future of food and our responsibility. Now, this is something that, as chefs, go to the next slide just for a second, and you get to have a fun little flame of orange essential oil. But flavor is everything. Flavor is what determines our satiety. What is satisfying to you? And when you look at the world right now, when you look at the culinary world and the way people eat, people want to be satisfied, and that's fine. They shouldn't feel otherwise. But the food has been diluted. You know, convenience food, speaking to you, sir, convenience food right now is not where it can be. And if we have the right dialogue, the right interaction, we have a capacity to create a food that is satisfying, whether it's, created by yourself at home or on an industrial level, that is satisfying in small portions with that intense flavor that you don't need to eat too much. You don't need to, indulge in taking refuge in food that is really so bad for you. And that means that you also need to be able to cook for yourself. And that's our responsibility. We need to make cooking a more practical process. And so I'll show you in a few minutes a few steps that can be taken to make food that more practical. I will also show you the other opposite, where we're talking about the high end of cooking and where convenience foods can take that technology and make the food that they give you that much better. And you have to look at the whole spectrum. always. You always have to look at that bridge. One does not exist without the other. So here we have, I just had essential oils being burnt off from an orange, and this is essential oils and volatiles, lovely aroma, blossoms. A hamburger. Now, a hamburger is a delicious thing. You don't need to have a giant, like four-tiered, Big Mac to be satisfied by a cheeseburger. But what's wonderful about the flavor of grilling? Well, we discovered, and something that's been known for a little bit for a while, that the drippings, so when you see those flames that are hitting the burger itself, it's the fat that's being pyrolyzed by the flame that comes up as another gas and then falls back down on the burger that gives it that grilled flavor. So that's why vegetables and things that have low fat will not have a pronounced of a flavor of that grilledness, that's not a word, but I'm using it right now, that grilledness that you identify with great barbecue. Fat is essential. So then you can apply that to, however you want. If you cook zucchini, put a little bit of butter on there, get those flavors flowing, and it's a wonderful thing. And again, if you can have intense flavor without having to have too much food, that is our goal all the way. Now, flavor and aroma are two different things. Tastes are savory, sweet, acid, bitter, umami, and we have fish and chips. This is fish and chips. This covers pretty much all of them. You have the lemon, you have the fish, you have the malt vinegar powder, the bitters, the crispy, savory fish with a little bit of sweetness from the potatoes. And now we're covering all the spectrums. And so what is satisfying? Well, what's satisfying is balance. So now here we're referring to something very classic, but we're also referring to balance. What's another aspect of our food experience that's very important? Community, sharing. A paella is the most wonderful example I can think of because in Seattle, I live in Seattle now because we created this book in Seattle, but even in Spain, I remember having these giant paellas and everyone would come together and the idea of sharing food and having conversation about the food while you're eating was an incredibly satisfying, complete experience. You didn't need to have too much of it. You just wanted to have the experience of sharing and taste. And again, taste being the foremost aspect of that. But it was a wonderful insight for me on what I think I could contribute to delicious food. And then there's the historic reference. So we all have I'm French. This is a pot-au-feu, or my interpretation of pot-au-feu. But having reference, so if you have your mom's food, your grandmother's food, your country's food, having a memory of that, is very inspiring and also very satisfying. We studied this a lot in the book. We did a barbecue map. We did a map of Indian curries. And we studied how food evolved through time, through geography. And I think that's very fascinating, and I hope all of you get to see this. I mean, it was very limited because we only got to do barbecue and curry, but you think about noodles, you think about all of the different products that came from America to Italy. I mean, there's so much interesting exchange and history behind every sort of food culture, that it's a fascinating subject to explore. And again, I'm going way too fast. Aesthetics and evolving roles of food. So, how food looks is I wouldn't say that. Flavor is more important. I'd rather eat some really ugly bowl of food that tastes delicious than have beautiful food that tastes bland. That's the truth. But secondary to that, you want to explore what you can do to your food to make it beautiful. And that's something that's been done since Escoffier times. So this is a chauffroid from Escoffier times where you had banquet cooking. Then I go to a plate. So this is a bowl of a very modernist ramen. But this is a plated dish of food. And the idea of actually plating food for you, that the food was put in a bowl or a plate for you from the kitchen, is as recent as the 1960s. Some people will say that the Trois Gros were the first to do a plated dish of food, and it was called a salmon with sorrel. And it was, you know, wasn't that pretty necessarily, but it was just a piece of fish and some sorrel sauce. And they, instead of coming out and just, you know, coming like buffet style or serving you from this big platter, plated the food for you. And so the relationship that we've created with food now, where we expect to have food come out in a very organized way, very aesthetic way, has evolved tremendously. And I say that, you know, we have more modernist plate-ups. This is like a Michel Gargouillou, where now we're talking about landscapes, go farther into that latte arts, you know, that we're talking about the potential of the barista. And now we're going into things that are mysterious. I mean, what is that? Anybody? What? It's an apple. So actually, it's our interpretation in modernist cuisine of a spherified, what are they called? Sichuan dumplings, like with the juice inside the dumpling, and we've actually spherified them. And so these are just spheres that have a crab in the center, a pork juice around it, and then we have the pasta around it. It's very classical in nature. The experience of it, if you tasted it, would be very classical. But the aesthetic is very unique. What do you think that is? Yes, there is absolutely activa involved. And it composes tuna and escalar, and we've made carpaccio of using meat glue. Meat glue is a chef term, but it's a transglutaminase. It's an enzyme from the belly of a tuna, which is fast. It's actually a fascinating story. They created this enzyme for the army, where they thought that soldiers on the run getting shot at would be able to take this enzyme and rub it on their wounds, and that the enzyme itself would heal the wound as it went. Now, it was too slow for that. But having developed this enzyme, how would it apply to food? Now, it doesn't affect your you know, health-wise, it has no effects. Physically, it actually cross-binds proteins. So we were able to create a checkerboard of tuna and escalar with this meat protein enzyme, which is, again, I think beautiful, but surprising and eventually delicious if I ever got you to taste it. So you'll have to take my word for it. Cherries. I love cherries. Do you guys think these are cherries? At this point, probably not, but we tried to make them look a lot like cherries, and all they are is foie gras terrine, and they've been formed and then dipped in a beautiful cherry gel. But again, this is the aesthetic of modern cooking, where we're exploring what, you know, the aesthetics can be. Same thing with this. This is the pork roast that you saw from that cutaway. We cooked this pork roast sous vide, cryo-fried it, made it crispy and beautiful. It's edge to edge, cooked 58 Celsius, and this entire landscape is edible. You have edible coals. Those are prunes that were cooked in a dark sugar with Armagnac. Then you have roasted coals, and then edible ash powder, which is like pain d'épice, just colored with a little bit of ash. So it's, yeah, edible landscape, and it's surprising. So once you go from there, this is the heart. This is really, really, really the heart of modernist cooking. Precision technique. So speaking to Hervé note about this, we've got a little bit of a popcorn kernel exploding. Now, this is used with our high-speed camera. You say, well, when you say precision, what do you mean? You mean understanding how things happen and how much control you have over them. So sous vide is fascinating because sous vide or low-temperature cooking, and I think sous vide is a misnomer in general. You don't need to have an actual vacuum seal in any food to do low-temperature cooking or precise temperature cooking, because low temperature means you're cooking between 40 and 60 Celsius, and actually vegetables benefit from 80 Celsius. So all we're talking about is what is the best temperature we assume, we predict, we like for every food. So when I speak about eggs, well, I like eggs between 60 and 70. If I talk about fish, I like it between 40 and 50. Poultry, pretty much the same thing, 60 and 70, like eggs. Red meat, 50 to 60. And vegetables have to be cooked over 80 Celsius to break down the cell walls. So you have this, and so in the book we have like giant tables of every temperature and every texture you can imagine to give you that, you know, empower you to just, to make that choice once you have some form of setup for sous vide, low temperature cooking. This is a polyscience bath. You can do this in your sink, especially at low temperatures, with a $7 digital probe, because the volume of water will hold its temperature for several hours, or in a cooler. And you can cook salmon at 43 Celsius, and it's custard. It's the most beautiful thing you've ever had. If you love salmon, seal it in a Ziploc bag with olive oil. Make sure the water with your digital probe is 43 Celsius. Give it about 15 to 18 minutes. Take it out, baste it in hot butter for 30 seconds, and you will be a modernist home chef that I promise you is a better cook than most restaurant chefs, especially when it comes to fish. So cryo-fried pork, this is an interesting one where we combine sous vide and deep frying. I'm going to show you this in a second. But I wanted to point out the egg. The egg is a huge and very iconic symbol of temperature. You know, Helvétius was one of the first people to, you know, and obviously the onsen egg was before that. But the idea of how low 60s temperature will affect an egg and give it that custardy, beautiful texture. But that means that and we studied this, every degree Celsius between 60 and 80 affects your egg yolk and your egg white differently. Above 80, your eggs get green and tough, and you don't want to go there. So you got this, you know, this, well, I guess 60 is a little low. Let's say 62 to 80, that is your range for eggs. But eggs are delicious. There's so many possibilities for eggs. So you can do this for custards and omelets, and so we really wanted to discover that. Flans, everything. Temperature means everything, too. So this is a fun, gratuitous video of high-speed egg being fried. I need to show it to you because it's just too cool. And so this is like, you know, slowed down by 1,000 seconds, and it's just an egg being thrown in a frying pan. Now, how many times have you had a fried egg where the yolk is too raw, the top of the white is kind of slimy, and then the bottom of the white is kind of overdone and crispy? Personally, I've had it way too many times. And it doesn't have to be that way. So we really wanted to show how you can best treat each texture. Here's a really cool table that we developed for the book where we're talking about blended eggs at this point. We're no longer talking about isolated egg yolk and egg white. Every egg preparation has a temperature and dilution that's ideal. So this is a really fun exploration of how we approach these parametric tables. Now, what do you think that is?
Omelet.
Yes. Have you seen this before? So this is a mushroom omelet. It looks a little alien, but it's also, again, abstract in the form that we like. Where you take something very recognizable and you transform it into something very, 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 very unique and delicious and having many layers. So here, Johnny Zhu, one of our chefs, is actually preparing the filling. So we like omelette soufflée. Omelette soufflée is when you have the outside, well, actually, usually it's a combination of whipped egg whites into the omelette, but we're going to just make the layers distinct. So here we have a puree of mushrooms combined with egg yolk, white powder, egg yolk powder and egg white powder. And so we've reconstructed what an egg would be because most of an egg is water. So instead of that water, we've replaced it with a mushroom puree. Then we pour a egg solution over it. We steam it at 79 Celsius. 79 Celsius we found was the best temperature. So your omelet will be delicate and tender and invariably perfect. Now, you could do this with any puree. You could do this without the puree and just the egg. We've done this in our frying pan where you just cover it up and use your lid to monitor the humidity. And here Johnny is just going to cut it into portions. And what we like to do, you know, to make this the ultimate mushroom omelet, is we'll take this striped piece of omelet, which is, again, very unique looking. I think very beautiful, I hope. And we have a marmalade of porcini mushrooms. He's going to fill it with that scrambled egg that was in the sous vide bag at the beginning, put it in a siphon and aerated. All that fat with nitrous oxide allows you to aerate it really beautifully. Some fines herbes. And then we're going to fold it over and brush it with some clarified butter. And you have a very traditional mushroom omelet. And again, the experience of it is exactly like when you love a mushroom omelet, you know, your experience of it is like you recognize it when you taste it, you recognize the layers of it, but it's something very different. And that's exactly what we want to share with you. Now, if the omelet is one of the biggest tests of the chef, the roasted chicken is the second biggest test of the chef. This is the mother load. You know, if you can't make a proper roast chicken, they will not hire you. So I wanted to be hired, and I wanted to discover how far we could go. So here are some combi oven roast chickens. Here's a page from Modernist Cuisine that describes the process that we share with you. And I'm going to share a video about what our ideal roast chicken is. So Aaron here is pulling some brine in, and he's going to inject it into the breast. And here's the issue with a roast chicken in general. The legs, and you've seen this a million times, if you like to make roast chicken, the legs cook at a higher temperature than the breasts. And often your oven is too hot to make the breast juicy and the legs perfect. It's impossible. It's just like a physically impossible phenomenon. So what we do is we inject them with brine, just the breasts, put them in the fridge, hang them for three days. But you see how we don't trust the legs? Trusting is a total delusion of cooking. You want your chicken to be evenly spaced so that it cooks really evenly. Aaron's going to inject some more brine because we injected it with a very light brine. We didn't want it to be cured. You know how the turkey that you get from the supermarket has that like hammy texture? We didn't want that. So he injects a second one just to season it. And then we cook it at 140 Fahrenheit, which is 60 Celsius. It takes about 4 hours to get the temperature right. And these chickens look kind of pale and boring, but they are so juicy. And at this point, we have our chicken. They look, yeah, again, a little pale, but what we're going to do is we're going to turn up our oven, and we're very lucky to have a rational oven which has very precise temperature. The ovens that you have at home are archaic, death, you know, chambers of bad food. You need to have, you know, ovens, and there's no reason that you shouldn't have ovens at this precision. So what we did is cook these for 7 minutes at 575, and you're basically oven frying. And the outside of the chicken is going to be like glass, and the inside is going to be, so when we tap this, I wish you had sound, you would hear like cracking. And the outside of the chicken is like glass, and the inside is juicy as, I mean, just look at that chicken with the juices running. And so we serve this to some of the biggest chefs, all of our food writers, and I wish I could serve it to all of you one day. Maybe one day, we'll figure it out. But, you know, you're serving something that's so classic. But using our understanding of precision, our technological, you know, know-how and possibility, and the legs and the breasts come out perfectly cooked each time. The skin is crispy and beautiful, and we serve it with a jus gras, which is an emulsion of chicken jus and chicken fat, which I will explain a little bit later. Le cheeseburger. So. Another one of, how are we doing on time, by the way? I don't know if I need someone to tell me. I'll keep on going until I'm thrown off the stage, so we'll go. Le cheeseburger. So this is one of the fun photos from the book. And we constructed every layer of that. We made our own bun. We made our own cheese. Cheese, constructed cheese using sodium citrate, so we can make that texture of American cheese using Gruyère or Comté. And the patty is the most important. So we use a grind of our favorite meats. We cook it sous vide, We don't actually vacuum seal it. This is a Ziploc bag so that you don't compress the cells. You want the cells to be of the parts of the meat not to be compressed. So we cook it at 54 Celsius. We dip it in liquid nitrogen, of course. And what that does is freeze the surface, only the surface though, so we keep the warmth in the meat. And then we deep fry it. And what's really interesting is that the rate of freezing and the rate of heating from freezing liquid nitrogen and frying is about the same. So we'll freeze the outside for about 20 seconds and then deep fry it for 20 seconds. And what happens is you brown the outside without ever cooking the inside. So the inside stays perfectly medium rare, and the outside is beautifully golden. You have all those beautiful Maillard reactions. So you have a super tasty burger, extremely tender and juicy, and there it is. Sexy burger. Now we created this just for our Montreal crowds. You know, I love poutine. I went to college very close to Montreal. I would come up here a lot to visit my girlfriend at McGill. And I would, you know, enjoy poutine every time I had it. And ultrasonic poutine sounds a little bit strange. But what we've done is basically create a fries that is treated with an ultrasonic bath before it's cooked, before it's fried. So what we do is simply try to keep things simple. So we'll cut our fries. This is Johnny Zhu, one of our chefs. This is one of the patents we submitted is ultrasonic fries, and he's cutting our fries with he made sure they were the right size, perfect. We like thick cut fries. He's placing them in a sous vide bag with a brine of 1.5% salt. You've got some baking soda in there and some starch. We vacuum seal them. They get beautifully vacuum sealed. We want to make sure that everything that's in that brine gets compressed to the surface. We steam them at full temperature for about 30 minutes. And then we put them in this ultrasonic bath. And the ultrasonic bath emits a frequency. Now, this one is a very high frequency. And what it does, invisibly, and this was just a trial and error thing, we just discovered this by having fun, is it ruptures all of the cell particles on the surface of the fries and releases the starch. Now, you can't see this when it's happening. So after having done that process, we pull a vacuum, on the fries, remove the surface moisture. We do a first fry, and you can start seeing that they are getting very fuzzy. And you can see that the ultrasonic has actually released all of the surface starch. Very different, obviously, from a traditional fry. And then this is the final fry. And look at these guys. They have completely lost their surface texture. There's no, fries that are just, like, linear. They are, like, little, like, crispy hedgehogs. And they also preserve their moisture inside, so you get this beautiful contrast of extremely crispy surface and very moist, creamy interior. And then, so we're doing our poutine variation. It's very simple. We have our cheese curds. We have our fries. And then we have the jus gras. Jus gras is making a second appearance. I'm going to show you this in a second. Highly stable emulsions. Poutine for the modernists. So, thank you. So modernist refinements. This is my last little approach to all of that we've done. Caramelized carrot soup. This is an iconic recipe of our book. And it represents something that's very simple, very approachable. We've all, maybe you haven't had experience with a pressure cooker. And my grandmother certainly did, and it was something that was sort of an archaic tool for a while. But a pressure cooker is something fascinating. What it allows you to do is trap steam and create, obviously elevate pressure and elevate temperature, the boiling temperature, in a way that's impossible otherwise. So instead of the water boiling at 100 Celsius or 212 Fahrenheit, you can actually boil up to 250, 260 Fahrenheit. What does that mean? That means you can basically caramelize at high temperatures in a moist environment. So what we did, and again, water, pressure. Pressure is created through steam. And we studied all the aspects of water in our first chapter. Then we introduced pH. pH is a fascinating thing. Now here, this is just the range of what happens to cabbage juice when you treat it with both alkaline and acidic components. So the middle is neutral. And then when you're going higher, you're getting into the high pHs, the very alkaline. And you go from a purple, you know, cabbage juice to blue to green to yellow. This is the same juice. It's just being treated and manipulated with its pH level. Going more acidic, you get that red color. So what did we do? We took carrots, butter, baking soda. Baking soda is an alkaline. We increased that pH. We pressure cooked it until about 20 minutes until it was fully caramelized. I'll show you the video, but we'll go through it quickly. So baking soda, and look at that final color and texture. We blend that into a puree, and it is so sweet and so intense. And it really reflects what my philosophy and my hope is for food these days and what modern cuisine has to give, is that if we can create food that is that much more intense, that flavorful, in small portions, then the people who, again, need, you know, are the populations who, you know, need a lot of food to feel satiated because of that dilution of flavor and texture. If you have a cup of this, you don't need anything else. And that's the thing. We're really aiming towards the essence of flavor and transforming what we eat. Delicious emulsions. Well, water and oil don't love each other, but we made them love each other a lot more through power. So that's a blender. That's oil droplets suspended in water. And what do you need to make an emulsion? You need power. You need a whisk, like Avi was showing, or a hand blender, or a rotisator homogenizer if you happen to have one. You should. And if you can blend things at 15,000 RPM, well, you can create things that are pretty impossible. And so that on the right is a rotisator homogenizer. And that allowed us to create emulsions that were pretty impossible when we began the process. And once we had understood this, this is a technology that's not far away from being part of your home. Like this, the centrifuge that I'm going to show you later. You know, the microwave used to be this giant thing that no one could have that was $1,000, you know, or $2,000. The rotisserie homogenizer will be, in some format, part of your kitchen appliances at Soetsab in the next 10 years. And that's very cool. And there's no reason that it shouldn't be. Like the steam oven, you need precision, you need power to create these wonderful compositions. So gelato, the jus gras, this is the gravy that we created. It's purely chicken jus and chicken fat. And we serve it on poutine, on roast chicken. And it's just, I can drink it. But it's really delicious. And what is this? This is our gelato. It has no milk, no cream, no eggs. How did we create this? Well, we used our very powerful rotisserie homogenizer, and we combined pistachio butter, pistachio oil, sugar, and water, and we created an emulsion that was purely based on the protein in the nut. And again, I wish I could have you taste this. But it is the essence of pistachios. And when we have chefs come over to the lab, when we have friends come over to the lab, and they taste this, they recognize how important what we're doing is, because we're taking away some of the preconceived notions that custards and creams and all these things need dairy, need eggs. This is vegan. Now, we don't, I mean, I love vegans. It was not my intention to enhance the experience of vegans, but this is a vegan ice cream, and it is so delicious, and we can do it with many things. Now, here's my final little tip on what the future of cooking can be. These are peas. This is the most natural, sort of fresh ingredient, I think, for me in my mind when I think about seasonal fresh ingredients. Fresh green peas, shonchan mushrooms. And then, that's centrifuge. That's a pretty odd, you know, juxtaposition of things. You say, well, that's the sort of least natural looking, awkward, you know, piece of equipment that doesn't make sense with peas. But what really happens when you combine this piece of equipment and this piece of equipment, what it does is take a food and spin it at 27 to 30,000 Gs, and separated by density. So we combine those two things. This is the rotor. We have the bottles in there. This is an example of what happens. This is a goulash broth. So we've separated everything by density after an hour at that speed. These are the peas going in. And I have a little video for you that I really want to share. And so, really, again, we are taking, you know, when you talk about natural and artificial and manipulated and processed foods, and, you know, there's so many processed foods that are as natural as they get. They just, you know, have to be manipulated to be what that final product will be. Well, we've pureed those peas, make sure the bottles are the same weight. So, Anjana here, one of our lovely chefs, is going to spin this at a very high speed. And once it's done, what do you have? Well, we have three very distinct layers. And I can show you this next photo. You have on the bottom, when we send it, you know, again, when we separate things by density, on the bottom you have this very clear layer of starch. It's got a nice color, has no flavor whatsoever, and is very useful for making delicious bread green crackers or pasta. On the top, you have the juice, and the juice is gold, liquid gold. It tastes like the essence of peas. It's so sweet. That's when you realize that starch inhibits your flavor perception. So remove starch from that equation. We've done this with corn as well. And the juice is one of the most beautiful things you will ever be able to use as an ingredient. So you must have a stovetop centrifuge at home, please. Please, please, please. And again, I've been talking to Cuisinart and all these guys, and we're gonna figure it out. You guys are going to have centrifuges soon enough. And basically, so you've got this juice, and we use that as a broth, as a dressing. In the middle, now this is the really, really, really cool part. You have this layer of what we call pea butter. And it really does have the texture of soft, sweet butter. It has the flavor concentration of 1,000 green peas. It's delicious. And we serve it as it's 3 to 5% yield. So it's not very economical if you're looking to, you know, have your pea butter factory. But it's delicious, and the texture is beautiful. And if you spread it on toast, you have the most excellent bread and butter experience imaginable. And we always serve it at the beginning of our meals at the lab. So here's an example of that. A little walnut toast with pea butter, and then the broth being served with all the beautiful spring vegetables. And that's it. That's it. Voila.
Thank you so much, Maxime, for that fascinating presentation. We will now stop for intermission. You are welcome to visit the bookstore downstairs, have a coffee, or sign up for our food lab tours. See you in 10 minutes.
And I'll be happy to talk about, answer questions when
Maxime will be available for questions.
Yes, absolutely.